The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
Investors should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of investment company products carefully before investing. The prospectus contains this and other information about the investment company. Prospectuses may be obtained from your advisor and should be read in full. All guarantees are backed by the claims-paying ability of the issuing insurer. Withdrawals and death benefits are subject to income tax. If withdrawals and other distributions are received prior to age 59 and a half, a 10% penalty may apply. Shares, when redeemed, may be worth more or less than the original cost.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show. On today's show, we're going to answer a few listener emails. Just assuming nobody calls in, we'll take live calls today. So if you're listening to this in the 3:30 to 4:30 p.m. hour Mountain Time on Monday, June, what is today, the 11th, I think. That's when you're listening. It's live. You could call in to the phone number is 970-530-0556. If you call in, we'll give you priority over those questions we're answering via email. But while we're waiting for people to call in, we will. They may or may not.
Waiting, you're
in.
Optimistic. We haven't been.
I thought so.
We haven't broadcasted live in what seems like
couple
eons.
Weeks, yeah.
Couple weeks. I think it's been like 14 months.
Oh, come on! No,
it's been a while.
So
well, I wasn't around much in June.
Right.
July rather. No. May.
Yeah. It's a month next to June.
I was going the other direction.
Yeah. So we do have a plethora of email questions, so we'll have plenty to talk about. But some of them, I think, mutual fund expenses come up.
HSA
and,
accounts.
HSA accounts.
And variable annuities.
And variable, just a potpourri of topics.
None of them are related to
each
other.
Are we really able to talk all through all of that in an hour or so?
Well, I know I could because I can do it in 10 words or less. You may
what
ramble
effort.
On a little bit. But
I think you gave up on that game we were playing.
I also, because your answers were lackluster at best.
They can't be real exciting with only 10.
Well, I do want to make mention before we begin that at the end of this show, listen to the Colorado broadcast. Chris is going to put it on this show because we answered two Social Security questions on the Colorado show that we recently received. And we talked about a topic that I don't think we really breached much on the show, and we're going to change that. We talked about the tax torpedo. Mm-hmm. And that is a industry term a lot of advisors have given to the taxation of Social Security as your income rises throughout retirement, especially as it begins to rise due to required minimum distributions. how the taxes on your Social Security can change. And it's been termed the tax torpedo. And I speak a little bit about a recent client just today, the day we're recording this. We're recording it on Monday afternoon, Monday morning. A client I met with in the morning, going over their retirement analysis, had one of the more egregious examples of the tax torpedo. And they were shocked, to say the least, over it. So we didn't delve deeply into all the numbers behind the tax torpedo, but we hope to do it on future shows for sure.
And, so, and just to clarify, when the tax torpedo hits your retirement, that's not a good thing.
I don't think a torpedo hitting anything is a good thing.
Well, if it was filled with confetti and it was, you know, like a party or something, maybe. But I just want to make sure people are clear. Tax torpedo, bad.
Yeah. Torpedoes are not generally good. Torpedoes, bad. Unless they're a sandwich, because back east we call them torpedoes.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you, in Massachusetts, you call them torpedoes?
Torpedoes, yeah. Oh, grinders?
See, I've heard grinders a lot. I didn't realize you called them torpedoes.
Well, yeah, you know how they're long and thin?
Well,
like
I get it. I get the shape of it, but that's a lot of syllables. Torpedo, that's, you know, Subway... Or sub, it's nice and short. Grinder, that's quick. Torpedo, that's just a lot of syllables.
Nobody out here knows what the hell a grinder is. That's an East Coast thing.
Really? Oh, there's a hoagies and grinders. Hoagies and grinders.
Really?
Yeah, there used to be a place that served grinders. Said it right on the menu, grinders.
Wow, no.
Although they probably had to explain to people, no, that just means a sandwich.
I would wager if I went walking through Fort Collins asking people, would you eat a grinder? And if I walked through Boston asking people, would you eat a grinder? More people in Boston
for
would
sure.
want to eat the grinder
but
than
Fort
Collins.
But how many people in Boston are going to eat a torpedo? Is that a Boston thing?
There'd be more people who know torpedoes.
That one, I don't think you'd find hardly anyone here. Grinder, maybe. But torpedo, that's going to be...
Okay. Well, we don't want to go off the deep road, or the deep end, rather, whatever the hell it is, on grinders, torpedoes, and subs, oh my, or we're going to get more bad reviews that these two guys just opine on the craziest things, and we're trying to learn financial planning and retirement planning in particular.
That's balanced with the people who like that we are unscripted.
Oh, totally unscripted. I mean,
someone
you can't plan
this. Made the comment recently that she left. I think it was a she, liked how the show felt unscripted, and I wanted to write back, well, it feels that way
because
it's completely unscripted.
Yes. I mean, Chris, we're not making that up. We've been doing this show between the Northern Colorado radio show, which we've kind of separated out the Colorado radio show now from the podcast, and we want to be going in a different direction with the podcast over the coming months. But... we never really had a script. At first, we were told by the regulators we couldn't. Remember when we used to broadcast live?
Oh, that's right.
As long as we didn't go to the recording studio with an actual written script about what we were going to talk about, and we just went live and talked about anything that popped into our minds, we were okay. They considered that a public appearance. And I didn't have to submit to the compliance. This is a different compliance service than I use now. Now I use a company called Cambridge, and they were okay with it. Then when I started wanting to not go live as often and record shows, that's where the scripting came in differently, and the regulators said, well, again, as long as it's not available on demand and it's you and Chris just talking unscripted, we're okay with it because it's only going to play once. It's when we went onto iTunes that all the problems happened. Mm-hmm. When we now wanted to put it on iTunes, the regulators said, well, wait a minute, scripted or not, if it's available on demand... it is now an advertisement, and advertisements have to be approved because you're a practicing financial advisor. And ever since day one, I mean, even now that we have to get these approved by compliance, there still is no script. I think
no, we'll just bounce back and forth a few ideas of what we want to talk about, or we'll say, hey, did you see that email on such and such? Or, but that's about it. So that's how hoagies and grinders come up.
Oh, my. My point is this. If we can't talk for an hour, about what the hell you teach at CSU and I do for a living, maybe you should be teaching this at CSU and I shouldn't be doing this for a living. So, and that's, I mean, if it was scripted, you can always tell those scripted shows. It's, you can almost hear the paper moving as they're, and that paper you heard was my printed emails. You all may send them to me electronically. I actually print them. But I have listened to competitor shows before. You can almost hear the scripted pages being turned as they're reading what is written there. And it just, nah, let me just say what's coming to my mind. Because with me, you never know what's coming out of my head.
True.
Or mouth.
Or either one.
Or either one. When they're both in cahoots, and or the mouth is moving faster than the head, or the head is moving slower than the mouth, that's when I run into trouble. Okay, this first email came in April 12th. Something happened on April 12th. Someone's birthday or something. I forget. But something of importance happened on April 12th. But anyways.
We got this email.
We did. We got this email. This is titled, Three Short Questions. And they are fairly short, and there are three of them. But they have to do with mutual funds.
Mm-hmm.
So make sure at some point, because I said the dreaded four-letter word, according to the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, I said mutual fund, you play the mutual fund disclosure.
Oh, I will.
Do you want to play the silly thing now, or do you want to add it to the end of the show?
I'll glue it in here somewhere.
Okay. And that's according to the regulators, to protect our listeners.
Mm-hmm.
From what? I have no idea.
Voices. Scariness of our voices.
Because I said the word mutual fund. Ooh, and I'm also going to say the word variable annuity.
I know. This is,
I mean, this is a double whammy.
This show is chock full of danger.
According to the regulators, Chris has to pay play a disclosure because we are practicing financial planners. And every time I say the word mutual fund or annuity, variable annuity, he now has to play some silly disclosure. Okay, can you please explain the following? I am a longtime listener and have three short questions regarding fees and dollar cost averaging on a monthly basis. She also begins it, I think, a little tongue-in-cheek. Hello, Chris, Jim, Chris, and Justin. Greetings from sunny Oregon. I don't think Oregon's sunny. The person I just spoke about,
part of it,
with the tax
part.
Torpedo, he's heading to Oregon, and he said the place he's going to visit this friend of his gets 100 inches of rain a year.
Oh, my gosh.
They're right on the coast.
That's a lot.
Yeah, 100 inches of rain.
I drove through Oregon a couple summers ago, and it was hot and sunny, so it could happen.
Okay. Well, maybe she's not being tongue-in-cheek. Okay. But anyways, greetings from sunny Oregon. I'm a longtime listener. I have three short questions regarding fees and dollar cost averaging on a monthly basis. Question number one. Can you please explain how mutual fund companies deduct their fees? Is it on a daily basis or from the year-end balance? So why don't we stop there and answer that one first. So that one required Chris and I to do a little bit of digging and a little bit of chatting because it's one that I never really thought. My mind and gut wanted to say daily. You initially thought quarterly. And I thought yearly could also be it as well. And as we dug, what did you find?
Well, what I found is generally they're going to, while they may not remove the cash from the fund, they accrue the expenses on a daily basis.
Yep, daily basis.
So where my quarterly comment came in might have variable been when they actually remove the cash, but that's really irrelevant because what affects you is what you're able to buy or sell the funds for, which is always going to take into consideration any fees that have accrued up to the point when you sell it. So you're obviously not, you don't owe any fees before you own it. Once you own it, and there could have been sales charges to acquire the shares in the mutual fund up front, different funds will be different. Some don't have this, others do. But once you're in, any of the ongoing fees that the company charges you, which they have to divulge, are going to be accrued and counted on a daily basis. That makes it so that any day you sell it, you're going to pay for the fees that you have owed during the time you owe
it. But think about it, folks. If they didn't do it that way, and you knew when they were going to be deducting the fees, let's say it was quarterly or annually, you may get out of the fund right before they deduct the fee and then get back into the fund right after they did.
So clearly they wouldn't want to allow that. That would not be fair, nor something they'd want to, because everybody would figure out how to do it and they would do it that way. And so that's clearly not going to work. That's why if they accrue it on a daily basis, they don't worry about it. What I couldn't clarify is if the daily basis meant trading days or if they actually use 365 days a year. I couldn't find that. I'm going to have to, I'm probably going to call somebody in the mutual fund business and find out how they do that. That'll be faster.
Because that was the one thing you and I discussed. Does weekends and holidays.
Right, yeah. And
or on Monday, do they make up for the weekend and holiday?
Right, and that I honestly don't know. I don't know.
That part we didn't know, but we felt daily was most likely how they do it. Now, again, that doesn't mean that the actual fee comes out every day, but they accrue it as a liability, so it's reflected in the net asset value.
Right. In effect, it's going to affect you on a daily basis.
So exactly.
When they actually take the cash out to pay a fee for something is irrelevant, really, because it's not like you could have avoided the fee by timing when you sold the shares or not. So and just consider it daily.
It's kind of the same when you work with a financial advisor. Many advisors who charge what are known as asset under management fees will debit them monthly, quarterly, semi-annually. I've never seen anyone do it annually. Most are quarterly. Mm-hmm. Some do it monthly. I've never seen daily or weekly. But they accrue. So if you leave the services of that advisor 2 days before he or she was going to debit a quarterly fee, they will accrue that, and as they give you your money, they'll withhold their fees. Mm-hmm. Now, if they bill, depends if they're billing forward or in arrears. But if they've billed you forward, in other words, you've prepaid for that quarter, and you already gave them the money, and you leave halfway in, they will give you half your fee back.
Right.
If you leave 1 day into the quarter, you'll get most of your fee back because they'll only keep 1 day, but they'll prorate it as well. So we just assumed the mutual funds would do something similar, but I thought in my mind they would do it daily. We just didn't know, and I still don't know when they actually debit the fees. Now, if you ever wanted to know when the actual dollar comes out, they're accruing it. It's being reflected in the net asset value that you see. It's just accruing on the balance sheet as a liability. If you want to know when they actually take the cash out of the mutual fund, not that it matters. All mutual funds hold a little bit in cash. Even a index fund will have a minuscule amount for daily redemptions and fees. You can find that maybe not in the prospectus, but you can get it in the statement of additional information. That's an additional document you can request from mutual funds. It's not readily, well, nowadays with the internet, I'm sure it's on all the websites. Mm-hmm. Years ago when I used to do this, you actually had to call the fund companies ask them for it, and then they would send you this archaic printed document. I would assume nowadays it's available online. But that statement of additional information has even more information, and I'm sure buried in that, if you wanted to know the actual day they're debiting the cash from the fund to cover their accrued fees, will be in there. But maybe Chris can find out how they treat holidays and weekends. That's the one thing we couldn't
find out. I'm curious for my own knowledge, so I'm going to find out one way or another. So,
my gut is telling me on the next business day. So I'm on Monday, they may be taking out that days, the Sunday before, the Saturday before, and if Monday was a holiday and they're doing this on Tuesday, then that day as well. Yeah. That's what I'm guessing, but I could be wrong.
I don't know. I think it's up in the air.
Or maybe with computers nowadays,
they
can do it right on a weekend or holiday. Because it's a computer figuring this out. It's not some guy sitting there with a calculator and a pen. I'm sure it's a computer that's figuring this all out. So,
well, it'll change the amount per day that accrues. Because there's fewer days for the same amount of fee.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
it's it'll matter a little bit.
And I would wager, because she gave an actual math example, and I don't want to walk through it because reading a math example with numbers and decimals and equations, oh my, reading all of this would be boring on the radio. But I would wager the statement of additional information will have the an actual math example of how they figure it all out. Okay, so interesting. We've never been asked this in nearly 10 years of doing this. Nope. I thought that was an interesting question. Mm-hmm. And then she begins with first a statement that I agree with 100%. Number two, fees are a huge drag on your portfolio performance.
Amen.
Hallelujah. Do we have that? Hallelujah. Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah.
Absolutely. Fees are. I've often told people the single biggest way I can increase your return without increasing your risk is to lower your fees.
Mm-hmm. It's like swimming with an anchor around your neck. You might be able to make it, but...
I wouldn't. An anchor? Those things are pretty heavy.
Well, yeah. Not a huge one. Maybe a little anchor.
Have to be a little anchor because those anchors are big.
The point is it's harder to perform. It's harder to perform overall when you've got that drag.
Absolutely. Fees are a huge part. I have read books by financial experts that list 30 basis points, which is 0.30%, as a reasonable cutoff point for a mutual fund fee. Let me interrupt right there. Mm. I don't know what books you're reading. Maybe if you're reading books for do-it-yourselfers on index funds, they might say 0.3 is the highest you want to go, but for an index fund, that's high. But I think for an active managed fund, 0.3, depending on what type of active management.
I think that comment is way too generic. The
mutual
fund encompasses all kinds
of
different investment funds.
Absolutely.
That have any justification for small fees up to fairly large
fees. Well, before
fees.
You go down that rabbit hole, let me finish your question then, and we'll go circle right back around to that. Because I thought the same thing when I read this part of her question. Fees are a huge drag on a portfolio, and then hallelujah was played.
Yep.
I have read books by financial experts that say 30 basis points, 0.30%, is a reasonable cutoff point for fund fees. Amounts higher would be considered too expensive. Do you think this is accurate? What about a fund fee of 0.40%, but that fund has greater potential from growth, albeit with higher volatility? So,
well, I think she's making a bogus connection because she's implying that the having a fee of 0.4%, that's the only way to get higher potential performance. And there's been plenty of studies that show that just because you're paying a higher fee, there's little correlation with higher returns because of those fees.
Or higher volatility.
So it's really, there's other characteristics of the fund, and we're not talking about any particular fund. This is all generalities here. There's all the other characteristics of the funds that are going to have the greatest effect on potential return. The one thing we can state for sure is the higher the fees, the more drag there is on that potential return. But someone might say, well, wait a minute, as long as the return is high enough, you can justify the fee. But that's where the research comes in, and I think about this a little more harshly, I know, than you do, Jim, in that, personally, I avoid fees as much as possible because that is the one place where you absolutely can point to it, and no matter what your returns are over a 10, 20, 30-year period, the lower the fees, the better off you're going to be.
Absolutely.
Period. I don't know what your returns are going to be over that 10, 20, 30-year period, but if you can make a conscious effort to reduce your fees, that's one thing you can absolutely do to improve your performance over that period of time. Now, picking one fund that's going to do better than another fund, now you're opening up kind of Pandora's box as to what actually causes that to happen and which funds will return higher than other funds. And so I probably pay above average attention to fees.
We do as well here as a firm. You don't, and the reason why Chris doesn't know a lot about this. He's not involved in day-to-day asset management services at a firm that we offer.
So I'm not privy to what specific funds that they're choosing to help their clients with, et cetera. I'm not commenting on any of those funds because I don't even know what they are.
He is pretty much the go-to guy for Social Security, does the blog post, does the radio show with us, helps counsel us on special cases mostly related to Social Security. Other than that, he takes so much time off, folks, because, I mean, he's got a full-time job, a wife, six kids, a couple of dogs. I mean, the guy's got plenty of time around, so he's usually out golfing, and he doesn't really pay much attention to other things in the office. But so I agree with everything you just said, Chris. We pay close attention to fees, and that's kind of what I want to talk to this listener about. She's using the word. Remember, on last week's show, we talked about we talked about annuities in general, and I think we would. Had the question of flexible premium deferred annuities on last week's podcast.
Yep.
And I told people one of the problems that I have when people say the word annuity is it can mean so many different types.
Like dog, like you said.
Like dog. So she's using the word mutual fund, but she's not telling me what fund she's talking or what type of fund, because a passively managed index fund or an exchange-traded fund,
which isn't a mutual fund, technically.
Technically, type of, is going to have exceedingly small fees because that fund is doing nothing but buying and selling and mostly just investing new money coming in, because it doesn't make one move unless the index it's mimicking makes a move. And
so they're not doing any research, trying to pick winners and losers. They're buying predefined baskets of securities.
Let's just say the S&P 500.
The characteristics of the goal of the index fund as described in the prospectus.
If you were buying a fund that mimics the S&P 500, your fund is going to own, assuming it is not an esoteric index fund trying to add a little bit of alpha by adding a few little other things. It's just a regular index fund mimicking the S&P 500. It is simply going to do whatever S&P says you must own and in what percentages to mimic the S&P 500. And that should have very low fees. 0.3 or 0.4 would be high.
Extremely high.
Crazy high. Yep. However, if you are investing in an actively managed alternative asset mutual fund, they'll never be able to do it for 0.3 or 0.4. Those funds might have a 1.5 to 2.5% management fee. And management fees are only one aspect of the cost of the fund. Now you have to actually go to the prospectus or statement of additional information, actually, Chris, and start reading to see what are the trading costs. What are their custodial costs? What are the other costs that are built in? They're not. The management fee is just what it says, the management fee. Right. It goes to the men and women, or computers in the case of an index fund, that are actually making the buy and sells decisions. But it is not covering trading costs, custodial costs.
And she's probably talking more of total expense ratio. More than a lot of people, you call it management fee, just kind of as a catch-all, and what they really mean is the total expenses of the fund.
But
which
the trading
is a number
costs
that you can look
are
at.
Still not reflected in that. Those are reflected more in the return numbers,
right? And the you can find that out more from like turnover information,
turnover ratio, and things like that.
How much
Absolutely.
Of the portfolio gets churned, if you will, that is bought and sold. Something with low activity, low turnover or churn will just naturally have fewer transaction costs than one that is, you know, every day they're selling 70% of what they hold and replacing it with a whole bunch of new stuff.
But all those transaction costs are not reflected in that mutual fund management fee that you see that's ubiquitous on a Morningstar report,
right,
where they show that.
You can get it for historical information, though, where you know, you can't predict for the upcoming year how much there's going to be in transaction fees, but they can absolutely report last year what happened in all the fees of the fund. And so you can get that, but you have to know what you're looking for. You have to dig into some more data.
And we've often told people that those numbers, even though the fee is not broken out like the mutual fund management fee is, it is reflected in the performance of the fund.
Yes.
Now, that's an SEC rule. So all costs of the fund are ultimately in the performance numbers.
Yeah, but people who are really curious about this are wondering, you know, of the performance of what happened with it, you know, how much of a drag was there on the overall performance because of this basket of fees that were happening on there? And, you know, you might say, well, yes, it just look at the net performance because that's net of all this stuff. But it's hard to judge from that how much of their performance was superior strategy or superior management of some kind, a particular technique they're using, versus, you know, how much got sucked out because of fees and that sort of thing. So it is sometimes nice to see them separated, but you're right. This is all going to ultimately come out in the form of drag on the return.
On the performance numbers. Another thing on fees. So again, she didn't tell us if she's talking active or passive. If you're talking active, I think you're going to have a hard time finding active funds at 0.3 or even 0.4. I just don't see it. If you're talking passive, I think 0.3 or 0.4 is 10 times more what you should be paying on a passive managed fund. Now, nowadays, you look at a Vanguard Admiral share, for instance, outrageously low. I mean, and Schwab and Fidelity, they're always fighting amongst each other.
Right, they're fighting to argue that they're the
they
lowest.
They have the lowest cost index fund out there. Because an index fund doesn't generally even need a human manager. Computers can do it by just buying and selling whatever the index does. And it's not like these index changes daily, Chris. They might change once every few years on a change to the index. Then you have to do rebalancing. So there are some trading costs in rebalancing to make sure the portfolio mimics what the index is doing. But all that is built in. And even with those trading costs, the difference in the performance of the index fund and the index are often, they're there, you can see it, but you're generally talking 0.2%, 0.3% total difference. So you're really tracking those indexes quite closely. If you were throwing another 0.3% or 0.4% management fee on top of that, I know there's a lot of active fund houses, I won't say their names, but I've seen them with index funds that have fees of 0.5%, 0.6%. And it just cringes when I see that. I'm thinking this is crazy. You guys are grotesquely overcharging for these index funds. If it's an active fund, you have to really look at what that active fund is doing. We are big fans. I personally am big fans of actively managed allocation funds. These are funds that will follow a risk profile, moderate, aggressive, conservative, are usually the big three, Chris. They will, and most fund houses have the, well, I can't say most. Most large fund houses have these. And what these funds are designed to do is own cash, stocks, bonds, alternatives, a little bit of hedging in there, and try to maintain a conservative level of risk, a moderate level of risk, an aggressive level of risk, maintain a 60-40, 80-20, 70-30 asset allocation mix. And they're looking to do everything in that one fund. And I've seen those funds with fees of about 0.6, 0.7. But you compare those funds to what they're trying to do and all trading costs and everything is reflected in performance numbers, you may not even need a financial advisor. I would compare a lot of what your advisor is trying to do to one of these funds, and you might want to say to the advisor, well, gee, what am I paying you 1% on top of this for? Mm-hmm. So I tend to like those funds. They're very well managed. They're generally managed by a group, not one person. And I'm just sharing this. I'm just talking unscripted as we normally do. Just trying to get her to understand those funds. I have never seen them being able to be done, though, at 0.3, 0.4.
Right. So the better, you have to be careful not to compare apples and oranges here. Make sure when you're trying to judge a fund for its fee level that you're comparing it to other funds of similar type. And this is something that website like Morningstar could help you with. They track this, and they'll give you information about fees and total expense ratios and that sort of thing, and they can tell you where this particular fund falls in the range of fees charged from similar funds.
Mm-hmm.
And then they don't mix and match them. They're not going to compare, you know, a certain actively managed fund to an index fund over
here. And then the other thing you have to be aware of is when you're analyzing fund fees and you're analyzing funds in general, compare them to see if the, especially on active managed funds, which we're not huge fans of here, except for the active managed funds that I've shared with you just now. Look to see, are you really just overpaying for a closet index fund? And you normally see it on large cap growth funds, actively managed large cap growth funds with expense ratios greater than 1%. And they're out there. They're a dime a dozen, those funds. And there's actually a measure I read one or 2 years ago, a professor, I forget from what school, came out with a new measure. And I was hoping Morningstar would pick up on this measure, and they haven't. It's kind of his closet indexing measure.
Right.
And he explained how he figured it out and what he does, and on his website, and God, I wish I remembered. I saved the article. Of course, I didn't have it scanned. I ripped the article out and put it in my drawer. I can't remember what drawer I put it in, though. I got to find that article again. Because it was real interesting how he came up with a formula for determining if your fund was just a closet indexer. And it was shocking at how much large cap growth funds were really just essentially doing what the S&P was doing, but because of all their fees, could no way do what the S&P was doing. And his point was, you're better off just buying an index fund. And in his findings and on his article, and then I would assume on his website, if I can remember what it was, he's trying to explain there's a point where paying does make sense, especially if you're doing a lot of alternative investments or expensive investments or one of these allocation funds that's going between cash, stocks, and bonds. And then there's other times where you shouldn't pay fees, especially if your manager is just trying to benchmark themselves, say, to the S&P 500, and they're essentially owning what the S&P 500 owns, closet indexers, but because you're paying all these outrageous fees on top of it, you're better off without that fund. So fees are important. I think some funds are worth more than others. I have no problem with low-cost passive investing. I just don't know what article she was referencing that said 0.3% is fair. And what type of fund are they talking about? She doesn't get into that. Mm-hmm. So that's my take on it. Yeah. But I have no problem with indexing. Just keep in mind with low-cost index funds, though, there is no downside protection built into it. You're fully invested at all times. Whereas active management gives some benefits where the fund manager or managers can say, wow, well, wait a minute. Right now we think equities are overvalued because of this, that, and the other reason. We're going to start taking a defensive position. We're going to start building a little bit of cash. Things that Barry James of James Investment Research talks about all the time. But Barry will freely admit there are times where passive is best and there are times where active is best. I think just like in politics, the answer is not left or right. The answer is left and right. They need to sit down together and get things done. I think the same thing could be said about investing, Chris. It's not passive or active. I think you should have both represented in your portfolio because there are times where active shines and for various reasons. But when you do active management, be very careful of what you're paying the mutual fund firm. But also, folks, if you're not a do-it-yourselfer, which most listeners are, but there's some non-do-it-yourselfers out there, and you're paying for an advisor, I think that's the more egregious fee sometimes because you get the fees of the funds and then the advisor fee on top of that. Mm-hmm. Now it's really starting to add up. So you can control both sets of fees. Sit your advisor's hiney down and talk to him and her about your fee and their fee and can you justify it? Are you going to cap it, which is the new thing we do as a firm? Because it's no harder today for me to manage $2 million as it is to manage $300,000? And why should the person with $2 million be paying significantly more than the person with $300,000? We cap our fee. You all pay the same. And to me, it removes our conflict of interest of wanting you to, oh, nope, only keep assets here with me. We find something better and you want to take your money somewhere, you pay me a capped fee. And I think that is where the industry is eventually going to go. This whole AUM idea that you're going to keep paying an advisor more and more and more as your portfolio grows, I'm not a big fan of that anymore. But anyways, I digress. See, you went down a rabbit hole. Question three to her three-part question. Can you please explain why some financial experts, and she ain't talking about you and I tell you that much in a minute. Please explain why some financial experts recommend contributions to a retirement account be comprised of 100% stock funds, i.e. no bonds at all. For example, in Rick Eidelman's book, The Truth About Retirement Plans and IRAs, he states, quote, place 100% of your current contributions exclusively in stock funds. The same with your employer contributions. Rebalance once a year, depending on your risk tolerance and age. I don't know why Rick said that. Rick is, I'm a huge,
well, maybe
I got a man crush on Rick Eidelman.
Having the rest of the article would be helpful.
Yeah,
when it
I
says
don't know.
Depending on
yes.
risk tolerance and age, that might be the qualifier for the first statement. It might that be, depending on age and risk tolerance, might not be just addressing rebalancing, but might be the asset allocation in the first place, going all stocks.
And then she says, I read the same or similar statements in Rick Ferrari's book. I never heard of Rick Ferrari. Rick Ferrari's book, All About Asset Allocation, and Jane Bryant Quinn, who have I heard of her, How to Make Your Money Last. Without actually buying these books and reading them myself, which I certainly don't have time to do, I need the context in which all of them are saying this. If they are writing a book earmarked towards younger investors or investors clearly in the accumulation phase of retirement planners, of planning, which tends to be investors in their 20s, 30s, 40s, absolutely 100% equities. I have no problem with it. None whatsoever. If you don't need this money for 20, 30, 40, 50 years.
And remember, it's not like you need all the money in one lump sum the day you retire.
No, absolutely not.
Your financial life, as it were, is going to go, hopefully, decades past when you retire.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really the whole time horizon we're dealing with here. We're not just dealing until you reach 60 or 65.
And even then, Chris, all's what you and I talk about repeatedly is the importance of bucketing when you enter that transitional phase of retirement, mm-hmm. what I now nickname purgatory. You're between work and retirement. You're not quite retired. You're not quite into working anymore. You're in this purgatory period. The transitional phase is generally mid-50s to mid-60s, somewhere around there. And that's where you are too close to retirement to ride out any significant drop in your portfolio, but too far from retirement to be overly conservative. Also, what Chris and I recommend is beginning in that phase, and you and Justin talked about that when I was on vacation, and we've talked about it on other shows. You begin moving some of the money you're going to need initially upon retirement. You can get the data from a good retirement analysis.
And that's the key part, what I just mentioned there. You don't know how much you need or to set aside until you've figured out what your needs really are. And
you
what
need
are the
a plan.
Resources
Absolutely.
You have? You need a plan. It all starts with having a plan.
Absolutely. And we say that, yes, we have a little bias. We firmly believe in our secure retirement income process. We firmly believe in the importance of a retirement plan. So we are biased on that. I'll freely admit that, folks. But let me tell you, the amount of people we have helped and the amount of information that we can glean and show them, like we just mentioned at the beginning of the show, the tax torpedo to this new couple I showed today. Please listen to the Colorado show that we attach at the end of this show. Was eye-opening. I would have never been able to predict the tax torpedo as I showed them. And when you listen to this Colorado show and hear what this is going to do to them, they were shocked. We would have never got that data, Chris, unless I did a retirement plan for him. Mm-hmm. But anyways, I digress. During the purgatory period, the transitional period, and the retirement period, all's what Chris and I are starting to say is during bucketing, Chris, you start moving money into bucket one and what we call bucket two. Your investment pool, bucket three, I have said repeatedly, can stay fully invested. 100% equities. Because bucketing is nothing more than visualized asset allocation. We're just separating it out. You have some money in cash, some money in principal protected or low risk holdings, some money in stocks, bucket three, and lifetime secure income, bucket four. It's not that we want you to break up your portfolio into cash, principal protected, lifetime income, and then, oh, you're almost retired, put your money in a conservative portfolio. You already have that designed. So you could still be 100% equities if everything else is in place. And I don't know if this is what Rick Eidelman was saying. I don't know if Jane Bryant Quint was saying that. And I don't know if this Ferrari dude, I wonder if he's the Ferrari from Ferrari Car.
I don't think so.
It doesn't sound like his name would be Rick either. Because Ferrari's an Italian name, right. Isn't it?
Probably be Ricardo or something.
Ricardo Ferrari? Whatever. But I don't know who Rick Ferrari is either, all about asset allocation. It's probably a book I missed reading. So I don't know in what manner they're saying you should be 100% equities. I do know if you are within, I would go as far as 10 years, but some advisors say 5 years, so that's up for debate, of retirement, and you haven't bucketed, and you have 100% of your assets in equities, that's wrong. Hands down, I disagree there.
There's a judgment as to the approach. It might turn out fine. It might be a disaster. That's the problem, is you don't know. And you're exposing yourself to the whims of those equity values, which, as we all know, things can cause short-term, medium-term, long-term effects, disruptions in those. And if you want to leave the success or the likelihood of your retiring at your target age up to the whims of the equity markets, then you can remain 100% invested in equities. Having other resources, it might be a way to call it, you know, we're calling it asset allocation, but having other resources that aren't directly affected by equity markets is wise and will give you the buffer there, will give you some more safety so that you can proceed with your planned retirement date and not just kind of leave things up to, you know, gee, I hope things work out. Now, when you do that, sometimes they do, but sometimes they don't. Talk to the people who either retired or were getting ready to retire in 2008. If they had their fingers crossed, I hope this thing works out, there's a slap in the face, that didn't work out, because when they see a 40% drop in their equity values, that hopefully, well, I guess if you had equities that were in such enormous value that a 40% drop wouldn't affect your decision to retire in 3 months, that bucket of people is pretty small. For most people, having a 40% reduction in the value of their retirement holdings is going to absolutely first cause a lot of stress.
Yeah, emotionally is going to freak you out.
And most likely is going to cause you to have to reassess when you're going to retire, when you're going to stop working, how much you might plan to work part-time in retirement. Their whole story just changed.
But if you have a 40% loss in an equity portfolio, mm-hmm. and you are 5 years before retirement or 1 year before retirement or 2 years into retirement, whatever, you're clearly in the transitional or distribution phase is what I'm getting at. But you have 10 years of bucketing protecting you with 3 years or 2 years of immediate spending in cash, another 8 to 10 years of money in 100% principal protected, you're not going to be freaking out over that draw. You might still not like it, but you're not going to have to delay your retirement. Delaying retirement is not fun, people, because we all know this is it. We're not spring chickens anymore. God, I know that. I took last week off and worked around the yard, Chris, and my body every night was telling me, you ain't 20 anymore. And I love that kind of work, and I enjoyed out there with my shovel and my dump trailer, and getting dirt and spreading it and mulch and expanding my garden bed and all this physical labor I did for a week. That was a great vacation for me. People think I'm crazy. I loved it. But I'm not a kid anymore. It killed me every night. And what you try to relate to with retirement is, if you lost all that money, you didn't have a bucketing plan in place, and we went from a stock allocation to bucketing, but it's part of my answer to this woman, and I don't know what these people were writing. But if you don't do it right and you have to delay retirement, Chris, it's not like you say, okay, I'll delay it 5 years, or next decade I'll do this. I'll work a little longer. This is it. We don't know how long we're going to have the health and inclination to do the things we want to do. And if you have to delay 2, 3, 4, 5 years because you didn't plan, that can be a life-changing event. Because it's not like we're in our 20s saying, oh, God, in 20 more years, I'm going to do this. I sit around saying, in 20 more years, I don't know what I'm going to be doing. I don't think I'm going to still be hauling around my dump trailer with my F-250 spreading dirt throughout my yard in 20 years.
Probably not.
Yet if I was in my 20s, I would sit there thinking, yeah, I could still be driving around this F-250 hauling around a dirt trailer spreading dirt because I'm only going to be 40. So I don't know in what context, listener, these people said to be 100% equities. If you are in the accumulation phase, I fully agree with that. If you are in the transitional or distribution phase, no. You have to start bucketing. But once you have bucket one and bucket two, or at least Chris and I's definition of what we feel bucket one and bucket two and bucket four all set up, cash, principal protected, that's bucket one, principal protected is bucket two, lifetime secure income is bucket four. Bucket four should be sufficient enough to cover your minimum dignity floor. Bucket one and two should be significant enough to cover the first 10 years of retirement spending. Once you have that set, your bucket three, which is what we call Crazy Uncle, your investment portfolio, I purposefully nickname it, Chris, with my clients, Crazy Uncle, because they know this thing is going to be up, it's going to be down, it's crazy, it's all over. That could be 100% equities. Mm-hmm. Because your other assets have been pulled out into bucket one and bucket two and bucket four. And all combined, you might be a conservative growth or a moderate type of portfolio. But your stock account could be 100% equities if you have those protections in place. So that again, she gave good food for thought, but no questions except for the first one on how we think most of the funds are doing the fees. Everything else is open to our interpretation. So there could be other advisors listening to this totally disagreeing with me, and that's fine. That's what makes our industry unique. These are my thoughts and beliefs on mutual fund fees and advisor fees, and my thoughts and belief on how you should allocate your portfolio. It all comes down to timing and where you fall on the retirement planning curve. Are you accumulation phase, transitional phase, or distribution phase? If you have not done bucketing, I would consider bucketing for sure in the transitional and distribution phase. You are going to sleep much better if your portfolio is dropping, but you know, I've got the money for 10 years. We prefer 8 to 12 years with a bullseye of 10. Some clients go 12, some clients go 8. You have that bucketing in place, Chris. It's going to greatly help reduce the emotional strain that market losses can give you. In your 20s and 30s, a market drop is a buying opportunity, and you're scrambling to find more money to put into the market. When you're in your 60s and 70s, you're freaking out because it's totally different. Okay, I think we beat that horse to death and can move on. Do you want to talk about HSAs, because we're running out of time, or the variable annuities? The HSA question is there. The variable annuity question is there.
Whatever's the shorter one.
This is me you're talking to. I could take
both
of these.
You still got to get home this afternoon.
I could take both of these down any rabbit hole. I'm not going to go on the variable annuity one because we talked about annuities last week. And if I start talking about this, we'll hold this for another show.
Okay. Because we'll have to do a little education for people.
I have to do some education on it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So the HSA one was an interesting thing. I just kind of wanted to point out a few things. He said it's okay to use my real name. I don't want to. She is a financial planner, so she listens to our shows. We have a lot of people who do that. She also sent this in February, so it's probably one
Eek.
Of the... Eek. It, because it's not really a question. She was writing in response to a show we did on HSAs, mm-hmm. and she wanted to share with us her own experience with HSAs.
Oh.
I just wanted to correct one thing she wrote. So I'll go through. HSAs, for those who don't know, stand for Health Savings Accounts. And actually, Congress, this would make a good show. If you didn't take so long answering that first question, Chris, we could have went down this road. Congress just had hearings on expanding and improving HSAs.
Oh, nice.
I don't know where it's going to go, but they invited the insurance industry. They invited retirement experts. They didn't invite you and I to go in and talk, and healthcare experts, and they're trying to see if there's a way that they can improve HSAs. If this moves at the speed and efficiency of government, I think by 2030, they should come out with something new.
Right.
Okay. So apparently in February, we did a show on HSA. So she sent us this email, which is more of a discussion of how she uses or how she finds HSAs. So she began, "Hi, Jim. I'm an avid listener to your podcast. I love the many changes that you have making with the show." Well, just a fan who likes the changes we're trying to make.
Well, this is back in February, though. So,
well, we made changes back then.
I know, but maybe now.
Maybe now she's not a fan.
At this point.
She may not even be listening to it anymore. "I'm glad to see your show is still going strong. I appreciate the recent discussion on health savings accounts on many of your shows lately. Thanks for mentioning the IRA to HSA rollover option, because that is something I did not know about, but definitely will be using in the future." We're going to come back to that with one of the things she said. Okay. "I consider the HSA my favorite retirement account for all the reasons you have mentioned on the show." And for listeners who don't know what we're talking about, HSAs are the trifecta of retirement savings. Trifecta. Because the previous trifecta really wasn't a true trifecta. It was the Roth IRA. You would put after-tax money in. It would grow tax-deferred. You would take it out tax-free. It's really not a trifecta because of the first element. Only after-tax money can go into a Roth IRA.
Right.
HSAs, if you follow the rules, are quite different. And one of the things Congress is discussing is expanding who can contribute to them and how much. Mm. And allowing the use of distributions for over-the-counter medications and insurance premiums. Mm. So if they enact a lot of these things that they're talking about, they're really going to make HSAs a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. The reason why Chris and I say they are the trifecta is what?
Well, if you do it correctly, you put money in pre-tax, so it's not taxed as it goes in. It grows tax deferred while it's in there, and then with a qualified distribution, it comes out tax free. So no tax, no tax, no tax is the trifecta.
That's why the trifecta. Okay, so this advisor agrees with it and wrote, "I consider HSAs my favorite retirement account for all the reasons," and those are the three reasons, "you have mentioned on your show. I was an early adopter of HSAs and started my account as soon as my employer started offering them back in 2008. So she's been in them for a while. Yeah. 10 years later, January of 2018, my HSA account topped over $100,000 for the first time. See attached." She actually sent me a copy of her statement.
Nice.
"Yes, it was down to $99,000 when the market dropped in early February, but has bounced back a week later. One thing I'll share with her, it's going to bounce all the time. I mean, oh, it's over 100, oh, it's under 100. It's a statement is what you would have had in a snapshot in time. It's not what you have today. It's what you would have had. I want to share with you a few highlights as a W-2 employee that might be interesting for you to share with your listeners. So she writes how she uses HSAs. And she's right on track here. I have maxed out my family contribution all but 1 year since 2008. So that's a good thing. She's maxing it out. I would rather. Remember, I talked openly, Chris, last year and this year. I maxed out my HSA over last year, over my Roth IRA. And this year, I maxed out my HSA, but gave up my fishing trip to Alaska so I could build a dog kennel. You sometimes don't have all the money, Chris, to do everything you want to do. But I always, always max out my HSA over my Roth IRA. If you remember, it was either 2 or 3 years ago, I told our listeners I had to make a tough decision. Mm-hmm. And my decision was I was going to max out my HSA and underfund my Roth IRA.
Right.
But to me, it wasn't that hard of a decision because I wanted the trifecta. And in the Roth, I'm not going to get it. Now, it does restrict me in retirement to using those distributions from the HSA just for medical expenses. But it's a fairly broad definition right now, and it includes Medicare premiums, not Medigap premiums, but Medicare premiums. Well, I know I'm going to have to pay Medicare premiums, so I will be able to deduct from my HSA every year my Medicare premiums with 100% tax-free money. That at the very least I know. But I also know I'm going to have medical expenses, and I'm also saving, and she doesn't write that she's doing this. I'm sure she is, but she doesn't list that in one of her ways that she's using them. Save all your receipts now because I can reimburse myself in retirement 100% tax-free for all expenses incurred, all qualified expenses incurred from my HSA. I don't have to reimburse myself in the year of the expense. That's what makes this so phenomenal. So I bring in my receipts. Laura. Thank you, Laura. I did it. I haven't called her Andrea in such a long time.
I don't even remember who Andrea is.
We never had an Andrea. We had an Andrew. Remember? And he left.
Yeah. Oh, I remember Andrew. I didn't realize you had morphed it into Andrea.
Well, when we hired Laura for like 3 months, I kept calling her Andrea.
I see.
In my mind, it made perfect sense.
I see.
See, I'm so terrible with names. You know what happened to me recently? I met a nice woman, was dating her, and called her Kelly. Only problem was, her name's Jessica.
Not even close.
Didn't go over well at all. And apparently, I did it 4 times without even knowing it.
Yeah.
So
3 was probably borderline. 4 is just too much.
You know, the 4th one was when I called her to apologize for the other 3 because she had ended it already, and I was trying to win her back.
Yeah.
So
you didn't tell me this part.
No.
This is even better.
This is the story of my life, folks. I'm 54 and single, and I'm probably going to be single forever because I can't get women's names right. I can't get anyone's names right. So to plan for this, I actually sat on my couch. I took out that Surface thing, that Microsoft, because it's nice and
laptop,
light.
Yeah.
Put it on my lap, opened it up, didn't turn it on, opened it up so it's staring at me.
Yep.
Put a big white sticky note on the front.
With her name on it?
Jessica. In big, bold letters.
Yep.
Called her up to make my case on why she needs to give me a second chance. I did not mean to call her Kelly at all.
Mm-hmm.
And during that discussion, with Jessica staring me in the face.
You still use the word Kelly?
I called her Kelly.
And she picked up on it right away?
Oh, my God. That's the one that just did me in.
Did you tell her you'd buy her a new wardrobe with her name on?
I kept trying to tell her I do my podcast and I'll be staring at Chris and I'll call him Justin. I told her how Julia walked into the kitchen not too long ago and I called her Steve. And this is Julia.
No, I know. No, I get it.
But I called Laura for the longest, for about 3 months, I called Laura Andrea. But anyways, that's neither
here
nor there.
Well, some people are more sensitive than
others. So I'm back to single again.
Yeah.
this whirlwind romance of a few weeks ago ended, and I can't get people's names right. But anyways, Jessica. Back to the HSA.
Jessica doesn't know what she's missing.
I think she does, and maybe that's why it's
a
over.
A lifetime of various names.
Anyway. She doesn't even know about the gymisms I mean, she's clueless.
She never gave you a chance.
She didn't give me a chance.
Not
if she
all.
Got to know me, she'd have been, yeah, that's him.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyways, it's neither here nor there. But it doesn't help putting the person's name on a big white sticky in bold letters. No. Because my eyes were looking at Jessica, my mouth said Kelly. And the ironic thing is, my last serious girlfriend
wasn't even named Kelly.
It was named Jessica. So you figure,
that's even worse.
Yes. A year and a half ago was the woman that I dated for a few months.
And that was Jessica.
Her
well.
Name was Jessica.
But you never called her Kelly.
Hell no.
No. That's the mysteries of Jim's mind.
Yes. Just never know what's going to come out. Okay, so back to her HSA thing. She doesn't list what I just mentioned, but the receipt thing is very important to know. Mm-hmm. Okay. My employer contributes about $1,000 a year as part of my max. That's pretty good. Mm-hmm. Employer match contribution. I think that's very good.
A lot of employers do that to try to encourage people to choose the high deductible plan with the HSA.
Absolutely.
They say, hey, we'll throw some money every year into your HSA for you.
She writes, in addition to being federal income tax free, my contributions are not subject to FICA because the contributions are coming from payroll deductions. Mm. I did not know that part. Because I know money going into a 401k is subject to FICA. So I have not confirmed that. This is what she wrote, but I thought to myself when I read this email, wow, if that is true, that's the quadfecta.
That's interesting. I'm going to keep talking.
You're going to look that part up?
Keep talking.
Okay.
I didn't expect that to be true.
Here's the key. She also wrote, I have never taken any distributions from the account. All my health care expenses are paid out of pocket. Now, folks, she's using the HSA in that manner. I freely will say, and I'm sure she would as well. Remember, she said she's a financial advisor. I don't know. I do know all people cannot do that. They don't have the cash flow, Chris, to be able to put money in the HSA and just leave it there and fund any out-of-pocket expenses, which with a high-deductible health care plan, which HSAs operate under, will definitely have a lot of out-of-pocket expenses. Not a lot of people have that ability. I do have that ability, and that's how I treat my HSA as well. And the idea is to let it grow and then start to take it out tax-free in retirement. But that's how she happens to be using it. I want to point out, and I just read a stat on HSAs when I read the article on the government discussion of these, the Congress discussion, that according to some research center, I can't remember the one, only about 53 or 57% of HSAs have, 53 to 57% of HSAs are actually used in the year of contribution. They're just putting the money in and taking it right out. The vast majority are doing that. A lesser amount are doing it the way she wants. Because that was one of Congress's questions on this. Hey, wait a minute. We increase this. People are just going to continue to use them as a savings vehicle and not use them for health care until later. And that's why that stat was shared with Congress that, no, actually most people use it that way.
Well, it's true that HSAs are the quadfecta.
Quadfecta. FICA?
Through salary deduction only.
Ah, that's why I don't get that benefit.
When you personally deposit money in an HSA, you've already been paid the wages, you get the income tax deduction, but the FICA taxes have already been taken out. But if you do it through employer salary reduction, FICA is avoided. She's absolutely
correct.
That's
why she wrote, because the contributions come from my payroll deductions.
Yeah. And I don't currently participate in my employer's HSA, so I haven't experienced what she's talking about, but makes them even better looking. Yeah.
So they have a trifecta with a possible quadfecta.
Yep.
Pretty damn good. Okay, my employer picks up the tab for the HSA provider fees, so that's pretty nice. Although I will say my HSA is just outrageously low fees. I use HSABank.com, And, I mean, it's not expensive at all to have the HSA, but the employer picks those up. Oh, she does save her receipts. I apologize. Mm-hmm. She saves them electronically. She doesn't give them to someone to scan like I do. Mm-hmm. My primary goal for my HSA fund is to fund my future self. This is the one I want to get to, her number 10. I plan on retiring from corporate America while in my late 40s. So she's very aggressive. That's going to be a tough retirement. But she said she's a financial planner, so she's crunching the numbers.
Well, if you save enough.
So being able to roll over funds from my traditional IRA to my HSA, tax and penalty free, is definitely something I am going to take advantage of. Thanks again for all the great information you provide on the show, and keep up the great work. And it's okay to use my real name, but we're not going to because we never do. I want to clear the air on number 10. You are allowed to take money once and only once from your IRA, tax and penalty free, and deposit it into an HSA. But it is limited to that year's contribution amount only. And if you do it, you cannot put money in the HSA. It's just a way of contributing. And it is no different than taking, let's just say her annual amount is $6,000. You could take $6,000, not now, she'd be hit with a 10% early withdrawal penalty because she's only in her 40s. But if you were over 59 and a half, you could take money out of your IRA, $6,000, mm-hmm. declare it as income, put $6,000 in your HSA and deduct it as income.
Right.
It's a wash.
Yep.
It's just letting someone under 59 and a half who would be subject to the 10% early withdrawal penalty essentially do the same thing. But it only counts for that year's HSA contribution. And it can only be done once.
And so it's not a way to load up your HSA with big rollovers from your IRA.
No. So I want to make sure she knows that, because the way she wrote this, it sounded like she was looking forward to taking advantage of, oh, I'm going to get all this money in my IRA, tax and penalty free into an HSA, and then take it all out tax free. Nah, it doesn't quite work that way. So, and again, if you stop and think about it, once I turn 60 in another 23 years, once I turn... Math's never been my strong suit, but last time I counted, I think I'm about 23 years away from 60.
Really? That's mental math. That's mental age.
I don't have my HP 12C in front of me, but I think my math is pretty close.
What about your abacus? Since you're close to 60, maybe you're more comfortable with that.
So when I turn 60, I could start taking money out of my IRA.
You could.
And directing it right into the HSA, tax and penalty free, because of the deduction. Because of the deduction. So don't read too much into that one-time IRA funding of an HSA contribution. But anyways, I thought it was a very nice email. I thought she was doing HSAs fine. I will again caution her on that IRA transfer. It's not quite as beneficial as it sounds. And I will also share, because you kind of not rolled your eyes, but looked shocked when she said she wants to try to retire in her late 40s. And it all depends what retirement is. She works for corporate America. Maybe retirement for her is get away from the corporate grind, work a more flexible schedule, doing her own thing. So retiring...
Teaching a little on the side.
We've
got a lot of people...
Retiring in her late 40s might be possible. Saving enough money to fund a retirement beginning in your late 40s without adding any type of other income, that's a tough one. But
you shovel enough money in there, it's possible.
It's possible, but that's pushing.
Talking about sacrificing your first 40 years of life as far as lifestyle goes.
That's pushing it. And she keeps mentioning her daughter. So she has a daughter as well, so kids, and that's a cost. And I don't know. Maybe she can do it. Maybe she can't. But maybe retirement for her is just a flex schedule out of the corporate world and I wish her the best with that, and hopefully it'll work.
For sure.
Anyways, I thought that was an interesting email. Not really a question, just some pointers, and I wanted to clear up that item number 10.
And we haven't talked about HSAs since that time, I think, so it's been a few months.
Yeah, we did. We had quite a few emails coming in on those. Next week, we'll try to get into the variable annuity question, which isn't that. You can see it's a very short question.
Yeah.
But also, wasn't there something we were supposed to talk about this week, but we didn't because Justin isn't here? And we'll try to do it next week.
Tax torpedo example?
No, there was something from last week's show that I said we would talk about this week. We're going to have to go back to last week's show and figure out what
else. Yeah, we can't because Justin's not in today.
Yeah, but that's why we're not talking about whatever it is I said we were going to talk about this week.
Well, whatever it is, we'll figure it out.
Okay. Well, again, folks, thanks for listening. This was another episode of the Retirement and IRA Show. Remember, we are live planners here in Northern Colorado, but we work with people throughout the United States. If you are a do-it-yourselfer looking for someone you can hire who's not going to try to gather all your assets and charge you an asset management fee, we very well may be the firm for you. You simply pay us for our time and our advice to give you a second opinion of what it is you're doing. So if you like the idea of sound planning, if you like our secure retirement income process, our approach to retirement, you may want to get a hold of us and schedule what we call a coffee and a second opinion. It's going to be a phone call. We're going to chat. I'm going to see if maybe I can help you. You're going to see if maybe you like us. And if the two work together, maybe it'll be like chocolate and peanut butter. Something perfect, or maybe we'll find out it's more like oil and water, and we won't work well together. But it all begins with a coffee and a second opinion, and you can do that right from our website called Jim Helps. That's Jim, HELPS.com. You can schedule that right there on the homepage.
Perfect. So we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
And listen to the Colorado Show for the Tax Torpedo next.
Right after this.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Rocky Mountain High, Colorado. Rocky Mountain High, Colorado.
Hey, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, Colorado edition. On today's show, we're going to answer a few Social Security questions that have come in from some listeners. Getting a little caught up on a few interesting topics that have come in over the past few weeks. And that'll probably take up most of the show. I think there's a release on some updated rules on Social Security that we might get to if we answer the questions in the allotted time here on the radio show. My name is Chris Stein. I'm here with Jim Saulnier as well. We are pre-recording this. We're not live in the studio this morning, but if you, as you listen to these questions that we're answering, if you've got a question of your own, you can just go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, HELPS.com. And you'll find a contact form on there where you can submit questions. That if there are 100 questions in a 10-page document where you're asking us to do a full-blown retirement analysis, we're not going to be able to answer those. But if you've got just a kind of a clarification question, or maybe you're running into some difficulty at Social Security or something else related to your retirement, and just want to bounce something off of us, we will do our best to answer that question for you. And if we find that it's of interest to our broader audience, we may do what we're doing today and use it as a question to seed a little discussion on the radio show or one of our blog posts. So, Jim, do you have a preference for which question we get to today first?
Well, we can, first of all, I want to welcome everyone. My name is Jim Saulnier, certified financial planner, as Chris said, here in Northern Colorado. And you are listening to the Retirement and IRA Show, Colorado version. But I don't think there's really a Colorado twist to today's show, since we're talking about the Federal Social Security Program.
True. Not specifically Colorado today.
No, not today. But we think the information is going to be interesting to most people because it has to do with Social Security, what is probably going to be the largest source of secure income for most people in America today is going to be Social Security. And the information that we share with you today, hopefully you will find beneficial, because Social Security can be extremely, extremely confusing, putting it mildly. Would you agree, Chris?
Yes, lots of rules and regulations, hard to follow, and at the surface it seems pretty straightforward. But the more you learn about it and realize that very small changes in your claiming, when you claim, what your employment situation is, what's your age down to the month, not just on a yearly basis, you know, how old a spouse is, when you pass away. And I mean, there's just all these variables that, come into play.
And one thing
that can affect your benefit.
One thing I want to get into totally off, it's kind of related to today's topic, but one we are not going to get into today. But I'm going to wait till Junior, otherwise known as Justin, comes back from his day off. He's kind of on a mini day off vacation type thing with his family today, so he's not here as we're recording. Today was one of the more egregious examples of what we in the industry, Chris, call the tax torpedo, the Social Security tax torpedo. Because of the way Social Security is taxed, we had a client come in today to review their retirement analysis. We did a retirement plan for them. Part of our retirement planning we do for people who hire us for that type of analysis is look at tax projections. And when I originally looked at their situation, I first begin looking at the graphs we create. So the first thing I start looking at as Justin is compiling the data is he puts it all in graphical format for me, Chris, and I saw their tax liability relatively benign and then jumping at one point right around what I thought was age 70, their tax income tax liability is projected to jump. And I just thought to myself, oh, okay, required minimum distributions, no problem. That's what I'm seeing here. And as I looked at the situation, I noticed that there was an age difference between the couple. Again, no big surprise. And I just thought the person with the older or the younger person had the larger IRA that was forcing the future taxes to rise significantly due to when they reach RMD age, because they were reaching 70 and a half several years after the older person reached 70 and a half. So I just assumed because the taxes really jumped, Chris, when this younger person reached 70 and a half, mm-hmm. not when the older person first reached 70 and a half. The older person had a significantly larger IRA, almost seven figures, not quite, a couple hundred thousand less than a million. Hmm. And I thought what I was looking at was the large IRA belonged to the younger person, and that's why the taxes rose significantly when that person reached 70 and a half. So this is all I'm gathering as I'm looking at pictures, because I'm not looking at the numbers yet. So I formulate this idea in my mind, then I start looking through all the data numbers. So I'm looking for confirmation, and I'm not getting it.
Right.
And I'm thinking, Junior made a problem. Junior is wrong here. He switched the IRA ownership or something. Mm-hmm. It's not dawning on me the tax torpedo, because I've never seen it this egregious before. And I'm looking for the numbers, and as I'm digging, I'm thinking to myself more and more, Justin didn't make a mistake, and I'm not throwing him under the bus. He kid doesn't make mistakes. Justin's good, you know that. And I have full faith in his data entry. And I started thinking, this is the tax torpedo. And listeners are probably wondering, what the hell is the tax torpedo? So what happened, listeners, and I apologize, Chris, I got off track, but I started thinking of that as you were talking. So we'll get to these emails in a minute. What was happening is when his RMDs began, and they were quite significant because he had over $800,000 projected value in his retirement account. But when his RMDs began, the income taxes were still at a level that was not pushing them into very high brackets. Because your initial RMD is about 3.7% of your account balance. So 3.7% of $800,000 isn't an overly huge amount of money, especially relative to what they were earning during their working years.
Yep.
So that's why their tax liability, even when he turned 70 and a half,
wasn't significant.
Wasn't that significant?
No.
Few years later, when she reaches 70 and a half, she only had $130,000 in an IRA. Her RMD was tiny, but their tax liability was growing $5,000. And you know why? It's what we call, folks, the tax torpedo. If you understand how Social Security is actually taxed, if you listen to someone talking about the taxation of Social Security, Chris, what do they always say? Up to 85% of your Social Security may be subject to taxes. And it's how they go about actually doing the calculation that very small RMD. And it's tiny. 3.7% of 130,000 is what? I don't have a calculator on me, but it's 3.7%
of 130,000, probably about
$4,000.
Between $4,000 and $5,000.
It was only about $4,000 or $5,000 being forced out, and their taxes were going up by $5,000. It was $4,900 and something dollars. Essentially, her entire RMD was being sucked by the tax man because that little bit of money hit the next breakpoint level in the taxation of Social Security and dragged in all that other money of Social Security that wasn't being taxed into taxes. When I showed them this today, they had never heard of it, and they had never seen something like that. And it was just eye-opening to see it. Because when I looked at the original graph, I just thought, oh, she must have a very big IRA, and that's what I'm seeing. And it wasn't. It's a small IRA. But that small IRA, combined with his very big IRA, was enough to suck in, I think Justin showed me the numbers.
And their Social Security. Obviously.
Yeah, about $27,000 of Social Security that was previously tax-free was now being sucked into taxes on them.
Wow.
And it just was eye-opening as he and I looked at it. So I share this with our listeners because a lot of people don't understand, Chris, how Social Security works. A lot of people out there don't understand the taxation of Social Security. And they think that if you earn more than $35,000 as a married couple, you pay taxes on 50% of your Social Security. No, it's up to 50%. And it depends on how much earnings you have, how much your earnings go above those amounts, up to the next break point level, which is 40. Is it 45 or 40?
It was 44, but
it's 40 something to hit the next break point for a married couple. And I have it here in front of me. I can
yeah,
look
we
it
printed
up
out
as
a little
talk.
Thing to yeah.
yeah. I can't read and talk, so you read, I'll talk.
Okay.
And Chris is going to find the next break point. And it's what happens, folks, to your income during these various breakpoints. And it's called, in the industry, we call it the tax torpedo. Because it's long and thin, and it lasts for a portion of your retirement until your income it gets to the point on a regular basis, Chris, where 85% or up to 85% is always being dragged into the tax heap, so to speak. And your taxes on Social Security now stay at a very set level. But between that initial point of retirement and the point where under current rules, all of your Social Security is being subject to taxes. What happens in between that period, Chris, really depends on how much income you declare in any given year. And for this couple, just about $5,000 more of an RMD, which is taxable as income, $5,000 more of income was causing their tax liability, Chris, to go up about $5,000.
Yeah, it's $44,000 for married filing jointly that kicks in the up to 85%.
Up to 85.
Yeah, and it's $32,000.
Oh, it's not 35, it's 32?
35 is the...
Oh, single person.
25 to 34 is the individual. 32 to 44 is the range on married filing jointly.
And when your income falls in those ranges, it really sucks more and more and more Social Security in. So from an effective or marginal rate, excuse me, you may be in the same marginal bracket, but from an effective rate, your taxes go through the roof. Well, we printed out all this to show this couple, and we'll be going over it again with them, but they were shocked, to say the least, on how much they were going to be impacted by that small amount of extra RMD. Now, the good news is they are still 8 years away from RMDs, and they're going to diligently work on reducing the size of their IRAs by, in their case, most likely delaying Social Security to spend more of their IRAs down earlier, and also selectively converting in certain years some money from an IRA to a Roth IRA. Both of those strategies may lower their RMDs to a point where they're not going to have to pay $5,000 more in taxes because the government is forcing them to take almost $5,000 out in an RMD on a small IRA. That was the most egregious example of the tax torpedo I have ever seen, where nearly all of the RMD you're being forced to take out is being sucked away in taxes because it was pushing over 25, I think it was 27 and change, of more Social Security into taxation.
And it's these types of things that I think don't get the attention they should. So many people are so worried about when they're projecting things and planning for things. Gee, what's my rate of return going to be? And
what's my break-even year?
What am I going to have to earn to do this, that, and the other? Well, that's a whole bunch of things you have no control over. When you identify a tax issue, now, admittedly, tax rules can change, but some of this stuff hasn't, like these rules with these haven't changed since the 1980s. So, you know, you can take some steps that will put or keep more hard-earned cash in your pocket, which is the key. The less you send out in taxes, the more you get to keep and spend
in retirement.
Well,
what we're going to end up showing them, they're going on vacation. They're leaving tomorrow on vacation. So they joked with me, yeah, gee, thanks, you gave me an awful lot.
Yeah,
you gave me an awful lot to think of now. I said, don't worry, they're going to be gone for 30 days. Don't worry about it. We'll chat when you come back. But here's the point, Chris, is here is a they're a classic case. And I this is one of the reasons I want to get the video version of our podcast and radio show live, the YouTube version, because this really needs to be drawn out. I want to dedicate a show to talking about this situation, and we'll do it when Justin is back. But it's not going to be as easy to follow because it's not an easy concept to understand how Social Security is taxed. It's not an easy concept at all, but they are a classic example where if they were to file early, he was going to file at 67, she was going to file at 66 and 2 months. If they were to file at those ages after her RMDs begin, just a few years later, they're obviously going to be receiving less Social Security because they didn't wait to 70. Mm-hmm. They're going to receive less Social Security and pay significantly more in taxes on it than if they both wait to 70, when they will be receiving significantly more. He'll be receiving about 24% more Social Security, and she'll be receiving probably about 28% more Social Security. They'll be receiving significantly more Social Security, Chris, and paying, you ready for this? Less in taxes on it. because we're going to use that time to reduce their IRAs down by spending it and converting it so her RMDs won't push them into the tax torpedo as soon as it would if they did nothing. Anyways, I didn't tell you about all that today as you came in because we jumped into recording. But as you were talking and I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, wait a minute, I got to share this with you. But I think our listeners might be sitting there saying, huh, what do you mean? You're going to get more and pay less in taxes? Absolutely. And I've seen this before, but only in the classes I have taken on Social Security. When I went down to Denver for some tests for some classes, and on one of them was a two-day one that Justin and I went to a few years ago. They had examples of this, but of course those examples aren't real people. They make the examples to make it fit. This is the first time I have actually seen something with this egregious of a tax torpedo. I've seen them before, but this one was so blatant. And how they, by delaying Social Security, will get more and pay less in taxes than if they don't delay, they claim earlier when they get less, but after her RMDs begin, will be paying more in taxes. And this is something that is sorely ignored by most advisors out there, but most do-it-yourselfers who, as you just said, Chris, they crunch some numbers. They look more for the break even. When am I going to break even? How long do I have to live? I got to get the money out now. Social Security's going under. All these scare tactics are erroneous thinking they do. And they're not paying attention to how they pay taxes on it.
Right.
And they're looking at what they might be grossing. It's not what you gross, Chris. It's what you keep after paying the tax man. And that's where people aren't paying attention on Social Security. Okay, so
well, and retirement planning in general.
Retirement planning in general, absolutely.
Tax planning as part of your overall retirement plan is a sorely underappreciated area as far as creating a strategy that can really have a noticeable impact on the quality of your retirement. I think it just gets ignored, and people just kind of they file their tax returns every year, but no one has put enough thought into an overall tax strategy that might span 5, 10, 15 years where certain decisions during that time period can absolutely lower the taxes that you pay legally. It's not a tax evasion. It's not a weird tax scheme. It's just realizing how the taxes are calculated. And by doing certain things in a certain order, you can change your effective tax rate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I don't want to keep chatting about that. I got to sit with Justin and see if there's a way we can talk about this on the radio show using numbers or examples or explanations that people can actually follow, because if we could draw it out and they could see the numbers as we can do on a video version, I think that would be a little bit better, but we'll try it just the same. Okay, so let's get to the first email question, and I'll let you answer it. I'll read the question. This one came in just, not too long ago, just about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. But anybody who is listening, anyone here in Northern Colorado, if you have a Social Security question, absolutely don't hesitate to go to our website, Jim Helps. That's JimHelps.com, JimHelps.com. Click on the Contact Us button. You can send us your Social Security questions. Or right from JimHelps.com, right there on the home page, about in the middle of the page, is a link to our Social Security blog, helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. You can click that on, go straight to the Social Security blog, and send an email from the Social Security blog that will also go directly to Chris and to me, and we can answer your questions. But this one came in from a neighbor of Colorado, Chris, Oklahoma. So he's in Oki. Oklahoma and Colorado touch, right? In the Eastern Plains, they touch.
No.
You know? What stands between Oklahoma and Colorado?
Texas.
Oh. There's no place in Colorado that touches Oklahoma?
No.
I always thought it did. Touches Nebraska.
We have our little map.
We have a... Someone took our map.
Yeah.
Who took our map?
What the heck?
Well, we had a map with stars on it, folks, from every state we received an email, but it's
That's
not here
really
anymore.
Weird.
I just know. I turned around with you to look, and it's not there. Okay.
So no, there... Maybe there is a little tiny touch.
I'm thinking Kansas.
I feel bad if there is a little touching. Oh, my gosh, there is.
There is.
There's
okay.
a tiny little touch in the bottom right-hand corner.
See? All right.
I thought you had to, I thought it was, I thought the little hat on Texas cut that off, but wow, I'm kind of embarrassed.
That's called the panhandle.
Yeah, well, no, it's the panhandle of Oklahoma, but it's that square part that sticks up on, I don't think they call it the panhandle of Texas, do they?
I thought they did, but I could be wrong. But I was right on Oklahoma touching Colorado.
So actually it does. So it is a neighbor, I guess.
Perfect.
If you travel into the far north, or far southeast.
So there's our Colorado relation to today's show. It's from a state that touches Colorado. Okay, he begins. My mother will be turning 65 this year and is trying to figure out how to maximize her Social Security. She did not work the requisite 40 quarters required to have her own personal benefit. However, my father worked and paid in. However, my father worked and paid in. While he worked prior to passing away at an early age of 56. So the father worked, got his 40 credits, but then unfortunately died at 56. My mother is planning on using the survivor benefit from my deceased father. But when we went to Social Security, we were told that she will receive her maximum benefit when she turns 66 and not age 70, because they said Social Security survivor benefits do not grow if you wait. I just wanted to make sure this was correct.
Perfect. So I will be happy to answer that and maybe talk about a few things related to that. Once we come back from this short break, when we come back from this break, we'll hear one of the top songs from 1935 as we look back to the beginning of Social Security. So I'll get to that question very shortly.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. And click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
Back to the Retirement and IRA show. That is High Up on a Hilltop, performed by Guy Lombardo and his band. It was written by Arthur Johnston and Gus Kahn for the 1935 standout musical comedy Thanks a Million, starring Dick Powell. And this was the second movie after the merger of 20th Century and Fox, and really started to make 20th Century Fox a serious contender in the movie studio business. But we look back to 1935, which is an appropriate homage today as we are talking about Social Security questions, and that is the year that Social Security started. So that's why we play that old song from 1935. So back to the question that was posed right before the break. Essentially, someone called in. They're checking for their mother. Mother was going to receive a survivor benefit on her deceased husband's Social Security record. He had passed away, unfortunately, at age 56. She did not have her own retirement benefit, so the only benefit for which she qualifies is the survivor benefit. And they had gone into Social Security to find out when that benefit would be its largest, and they were told that that would happen when she turns 66, which is her full retirement age, that it would not increase after that, as a regular retirement benefit would. Those of you who are familiar with Social Security and maybe listen to the show regularly know that if you delay claiming your own Social Security benefit after your full retirement age, you earn what are called delayed retirement credits, which increase your benefit 8% for every year that you delay past your full retirement age. And they had told her in the office that that wouldn't happen to her survivor benefit, so she should claim at her full retirement age. And this listener was just wanting to verify, is that true? And the short answer to that is
yes.
Yes. Yes, that is true in this case that, well, first of all, not just in this case, but a survivor benefit does not earn delayed retirement credits. for the survivor, for if the survivor delays. With that being said, so let's get that off the table here. Yes, they were given proper advice. She should claim at her full retirement age, which for her is 66, because there's no benefit for waiting. If she claims before that, she could get it earlier, but a reduced benefit. If they're wanting her to have the largest benefit for life on a monthly basis, it would be at her age 66. However, when I say that the survivor benefit won't increase for delayed retirement credits, that's only if the survivor is delaying. Take, for instance, if her husband were still alive. If he had delayed past his full retirement age, he would increase his own retirement benefit, which in turn increases the survivor benefit that would be left for his wife. So when you hear this comment that we initially said here, that survivor benefits don't increase with delayed retirement credits, once they turn into a survivor benefit, that's true. But when you're accumulating or increasing your own benefit to ultimately leave a survivor benefit, you can choose to do that by delaying past your full retirement age. This is why a lot of times in a couple, that each have their own retirement benefit, we will encourage them to consider, not in all cases is it appropriate, but we'll encourage them to consider having one of them delay to age 70. That's because when the first person dies, the survivor doesn't get to keep both Social Security benefits. They only get to keep one, and they are nice enough to let you keep the largest of the two. But because you're going to have a substantial cut in your Social Security, it's oftentimes best to try to have one of them be as big as possible so that the one that's left behind is a bigger percentage of the total than it otherwise would be. So take into consideration that you can increase the survivor benefit for your spouse if you're still alive and delay. Once you've passed away, then there's nothing your surviving spouse can do to increase it by delaying after their full retirement age. The other issue to consider, it wasn't the case here, that she didn't have her own retirement benefit, but pretend for a moment she did, that she had her own benefit and she also qualified for a survivor benefit. Anyone in that situation should either through their own research and math skills figure out what's the best strategy for claiming one than the other. Or what most people will do is go to a Social Security expert. We offer this service, others offer this service, where we'll take a look at your two benefits and figure out in what order and in what months you should claim each of those two benefits for which you are eligible so that you can maximize your lifetime Social Security income. That's not something in this case, but I wanted to make mention of it if you're interested in survivor benefits, but your story is a little different than the listeners here, where both spouses have a retirement benefit. We want to coordinate those properly so that the survivor ends up, again, not leaving money on the table, not leaving behind money that they are absolutely eligible for. Unfortunately, Social Security will not call you and tell you what to do in order to maximize your benefit. It's in your court. And if you can't figure it out on your own, make sure that you seek out some help to figure that out. But I guess that's the lengthy answer to that particular question. The short answer was, yes, Social Security told them correctly.
And if she was younger, I just want to throw in there, because she's going to be at her full retirement age next year, so it doesn't give much time. But if she was only 62 and a quarter, let's say she had 9 of the 10 quarters she needed, or credits as they call them now, it may have been worth it for her to try to find a job to earn what she would have needed to qualify for benefit.
Right.
Claim it at 62.
A stay-at-home spouse is close. They're not quite there.
Right.
And, and they get zero until they get there. And then once they get to the 40 credits, it opens up their own benefit and could really change a person's
financial
situation.
Because that's only a few thousand dollars. I think about $5,000
a year.
That they have to earn.
Right, to earn four.
Right, if she wanted all four. But if she only needed one, it's
and we have run into that with people. They're so close.
Yep.
We say, go out and find a part-time job or something. Get that last credit or two that you need.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of unlocks a whole bunch of different strategies And just more income that you have available to you.
So. Absolutely. So that would have been something that I would have recommended. With her being almost at her full retirement age, he just said the mother is 65, so she could be a year and 4 months at the longest away. If her birthday was just now and she turned 65, she could be a few months away from turning her full retirement age. I don't know.
Yeah, and since he just outright said she didn't make it, it didn't sound like to me that she was close. Usually if they're close, they're like, oh, and she was at 38, she almost got there. And then that would prompt kind of the follow-up on how could we get her those last two so she qualifies.
And then there would have been more claiming options. Yeah. That's all I wanted to share.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so let's get to the next Social Security question, which is a much longer one. We may stop and pause in the reading of this to take a breather and also to maybe answer a question or concern at the same time. But mm-hmm. We'll see. So this question came in not from a state that borders Colorado, as we just determined Oklahoma does. It is from Georgia. And last time I checked, Colorado does not touch Georgia.
I'm confident it does not.
Yeah, same here.
Although we share a love of peaches for some
reason. We do. The peach state.
I will tell you that I think the peaches in Colorado are better.
Than that's Georgia
probably,
peach?
That's probably fighting words for
then,
people
yes,
in Georgia.
Yes, I was going to say.
But I'm telling you, a perfectly ripe Palisade peach from the western slope of Colorado at the height of the season, the end of July, beginning of August, it's mind-blowingly good. And I have tried a Georgia peach, maybe not fresh enough, because I haven't eaten one in Georgia that just came off the tree, for instance. But anyway.
But you've eaten Palisade peaches fresh off the tree.
Regularly. So, yeah. More. I wish it was more regular, but you can only
Do
get them for about a month.
Do you trust, because in another month, maybe a month and a week,
yeah,
those Palisade peach stands are everywhere.
Yeah.
And I've often wondered, are they really from there? Are people just going to King Soopers, buying peaches, and chucking a sign?
Well, you can buy Palisade peaches at King Soopers. It's actually when they have them and they just fresh came off the truck, they're pretty much as good as those ones that come from the stands. I have two stands that have been there for years and years and years that I trust, so I only use them. And then I'm sure, because they literally drive them over in a van. And they've got them right there in their van.
Those are the ones I want, but I often don't trust that they really just drove them up this morning.
Yeah, I don't know. You can tell by tasting them. You'd know.
Okay. Because I've had some pretty mealy, gross peaches from the store.
Yeah, those are California peaches.
You bite into the peach and there's no juice, there's no nothing.
It's terrible.
It tastes like a tangerine almost. It's just not
Stay
a tangerine, a nectarine.
Yeah, forget those.
Yeah, those are terrible peaches. No. Dry, mealy. Okay, so enough on peaches. Yeah. Let's get to this Georgia question. It's a lengthy one. I'll try to skip but maintain the essence of what he's saying. I began receiving my Social Security retirement benefits in June of 2016. I turned 68 in May of that year. So when he was 68, he began receiving his retirement benefits.
Yep.
When I spoke with a Social Security rep concerning my choices, I was told my benefit would be, and here's where he starts getting into a lot of numbers, and I apologize, but he says $2,754 a month before Social Security deducts my Medicare premiums of $106 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So at this point, just let me interject to keep people on the story. He delayed 2 years from his full retirement age in order to collect a higher benefit. And that higher benefit, by the normal rule, would be 8% per year higher. So if he waits 2 years, that's 16% higher.
Yep. Yeah. And he waited nearly 2 years to the day.
Right at 2 years.
That's why he gave us his dates of birth. And again, he said he turned on Social Security in May of 2016, the year I turned 68, and that happened to be when he turned 68.
Yep.
So he got pretty much exactly 24 months of delayed retirement credits.
Well, he didn't.
Well, no.
That's
part of
the story.
As we're going to talk.
Yeah.
On paper, he did.
Right.
And he kind of did.
And eventually will.
Right. That's why I said he kind of did. Okay. I commented to the rep that according to my calculations, he was wrong. Remember, the rep told him he was going to get $2,754 a month. I informed the rep that I felt I should receive $2,810 a month. The rep did agree with that figure that I had and then stated these three things. One, the $2,754 was the benefit calculated through January of 2016. Number two, my January 2017 benefit would increase to the approximate figure that I had calculated,
yep,
$2,810. And number three, the rep said, I will receive a lump sum one-time payment in 2017 of $520 to account for the $66 a month delayed retirement credits in my payments from May of 2016. Remember, folks, that's when he turned 68, May of 2016. $66 a month delayed retirement credits from May of 2016 through December of 2016. That's what he thought.
And now, that's what he was told by the Social Security rep.
And the rep's wrong.
The rep is wrong.
Rep was right on the first two things.
Rep was close to right. Got that one totally wrong.
Yes.
Which he's found out, because as he continues, and I'm going to speed it up a little bit just for time here.
Yes.
The rest of the story is now he's been appealing. He didn't get that lump sum.
No.
He was wondering where the heck that, what was it,
he got the other money, the other 560, right, he didn't get, but he got the other raise.
Yeah, so 2016, just to recap, 2016, he turns on his benefit for $2,754 per month.
Beginning June
of 2016, roughly. He then received that through 2016 and then was expecting, because his benefit by delaying to through May of 2016 should have been that $2,814 or what did you have on there? I don't have it in front of me, so it's $66 a month. So
$66 a month or $2,810 a month.
$2,810. Which is what they calculated he should have been getting from June of 2016. He was getting short that, but then got a raise to the $2,810 in January of 2017, and he was expecting an adjustment for those months where he was supposedly paid short. So he never got it. He filed appeals. He sounded like in his email he was on about his third appeal,
yeah,
and no one had the heart to tell him, it's wrong. What you were told was just wrong, because that's not how it works. There's a weird rule on how they actually apply the delayed retirement credits. Essentially, instead of looking at it dynamically every single month, they set your benefit for the year in January of every year. So they're only going to consider, for him, in January of 2016, they figured out his benefit, if he claimed in January of 2016, would have been $2,754. By delaying a few more months, he would increase that. But it turns out that they're not going to recalculate his delayed retirement credits until the next January. So he gets paid starting in mid-year at the lower amount, as if he had claimed back in January, when in fact he claimed in May. So they pay you any delayed retirement credits you've gotten for full years through the end of the prior year, but they're not going to recalculate it again until the following January. And at that point, then he gets a raise to the amount he should have gotten. What doesn't happen is fixing the few months during the year, which could be a number of months, but fixing a few months where you technically should have gotten a raise if they were doing the calculation on a monthly basis and didn't, that you essentially got robbed, if you will, in his case, about 6 or 7 months worth of that $66. Well, when the rep told him that he would get that fixed, because what happens a lot of times is when Social Security has an error and they pay you an amount that's different than you should have gotten, you'll get it for a while, and then they'll fix the issue, and they'll go back, they'll look back and look at how many dollars they should have paid you in the past, and they'll just send you a lump sum amount for that. So for other things, that's exactly how they would handle it if they had made some kind of calculation error. Well, the rep's computer was not making an error. The rep's computer knew that he wouldn't get full credit for the delayed retirement credits from 2016 until January of 2017. And he admits, this reader, listener, admits that's what happened, but he's barking up a losing tree, if you will. And that sounds like a Jimism, right? Because it's a lost cause, and you're barking up the wrong tree. So I can combine those and turn it into a Jimism.
How about you barking up a lost tree?
Barking up a lost tree. That sounds exactly like something that would come from your mouth. It's a waste of time to pursue these appeals. It's a waste of time for you. It's a waste of time for the office and the managers there, unless you're lucky enough for them to make another mistake. But even then, you're probably not okay. Let's say you get a manager who also doesn't know how this is supposed to work and says, oh, yeah, we owe the $500 and some, so I'll process a one-time payment for that, and you suddenly get it. A few months or years later, you're probably going to get a notice that says, oops, we messed up. An audit found that we overpaid you. No big deal. We'll just reduce your benefit until we have kept back the extra money that we paid you. So even if you find someone who makes a second mistake and agrees to pay you that, I wouldn't bother, because you're going to end up having it taken back from you in the future, because that is not how it works. What we call missed delayed retirement credits, which is not a topic that actually I've really seen talked about on many Social Security websites and blogs and radio shows and that sort of thing. It's something I accidentally stumbled across when I was reading some technical document on Social Security, and I thought, wow, this actually affects a lot of people. And while it's not a big dollar amount, in this case, you know, it's over $500. You could do some stuff with $500. So, you know, it's not minuscule. In the grand scheme of things, he's making, you know, $2,800 a month, so 12 times that every year. So $500 isn't a huge dent in that. But it's real money, and it's real money you're never going to get. So it just has to do with the timing of when they actually credit your account with the delayed retirement credits. It happens once a year, except... there's always an exception, right? Except in the month you turn 70. When you turn 70, delayed retirement credits don't continue to accrue past that. If you claim your benefit in the month you're 70, they will give you all the delayed retirement credits real time from the very first month up to age 70. There isn't this delay till the end of the year thing. And that's the weird thing.
Then,
if they can do it then, why don't they do it?
If they can do it then, why don't they do it all the time? Because what you're describing is if instead of him waiting for the full 2 years, which still kind of screwed him out over 6 months of delayed retirement credits, $560, what if he... Or not necessarily him, but anyone. It looks to me like the worst possible time is June 30th.
Well, it evens out a little bit, because let's say you claimed earlier in the year. You get fewer, well, what should I say?
But let's just say your birthday was June 30th, so you claimed right in June, and your first check comes in July, exactly 6 months.
Yep.
You'll lose... those 6 months for that year.
You lose 6 months of 4% of your full retirement age benefit, yeah.
And that would be the worst case scenario, would it not? Or would it be January would be the worst case scenario? Because you would lose 11 months.
No, because you're going to get, in January, you're going to get exactly what you should get. You're not going to get a raise the next year because you didn't delay.
So June is the worst?
June, and then when you say worst, it's kind of offsetting issues here, because the more you delay, the bigger your benefit is. You give up some months, but you get a higher benefit for the rest of your life. So it is kind of an offset. And it's not big dollar amount. That's probably why nobody's complained enough to have it rise to the level where a congressperson would want to take this on as a quote-unquote fix to the unfairness of Social Security or something like that. But the one thing that does baffle me in this, I kind of get it. It's just one of those rules where it is what it is, and they're applying it fairly because that's just simply the rule. What I don't get is at age 70, why the heck do they bother to make the adjustment to make it right when you turn 70?
Well, that's just telling me if they can do it, then they can do it.
They could do it
any other time, and
they just
haven't.
Choose not to.
Right. It's a government bureaucracy, and they're tied up in that. Yeah. But anyways, folks, if you found this interesting and you want your own information on Social Security, don't forget we do offer a $75 Social Security analysis here in Northern Colorado and throughout the nation if somebody wants to hire us for that. But you can also go to our website, Jim Helps. That's Jim HELPS.com. Click on the Help with My Social Security blog icon right there on our homepage, and you can go to the blog from there and read a lot about what Chris just recently said and submit questions through that website as well.
Right. We get a ton of questions. We answer them on the blog. I cover any and all kind of Social Security topics in there. You might find an article that already answers your question, and if not, send me the question and I'll get back to you.
Excellent.
So thanks, everybody, for joining us here on the Retirement and IRA Show Colorado Edition. We'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.